With SRN News, I'm John Scott. The mayor of New Orleans says that city's water pumps are working at optimal capacity as Tropical Storm Barry moves toward the state's Gulf Coast. The National Weather Service says New Orleans could get 10 to 15 inches of rain Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The House Judiciary Committee has voted along party lines, authorizing a dozen new subpoenas targeting current and former Trump administration officials and associates, expanding the committee probe to include the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy. President Trump expected to announce new executive action today to try to force the inclusion of a citizenship question on the 2020 census. Any such action would likely draw an immediate legal challenge. And U.S. consumer prices rose just 0.1% in June as cheaper gas prices were offset by higher rents and auto costs. This is SRN News.
About half of us will see thunderstorms this afternoon. The high will be 93 degrees. This evening, partly cloudy. 1 in 5 chance of rain tonight with a low of 75. Tomorrow, an 80% chance of thunderstorms and a high of 91. Saturday afternoon, thunderstorms and a high of 92. Sunday, mostly cloudy with a high of 94.
Hey, this is Doug McCary from SWAT Radio. I want to thank you for being a listener, and Brad and I are going to be gone for the next 2 weeks, vacationing with our families, taking a little time off, but we will be back July 15th. Until then, if you want to reach us, don't call the station or don't call our number that you hear on the broadcast. Instead, send an email to askask@swatradio.com, and we'll be happy to tell you about SWAT or about future programs. We hope you enjoy the best of. These are some of the most requested programs. So have a great summer, and we'll see you on July 15th when we come back.
Ignition sequence time.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engines running. Commit. Liftoff.
Good afternoon. Welcome to SWAT Radio. I'm Brad Sykes here with my battle buddy, Doug McCary from His Light. And it's already Thursday, Doug. How are you, man?
I'm good. It's hot still. It's like July here.
95, I think.
95 and hot. And not just hot here. It's hot up in Washington, D.C. right now with everything going on. And listen, wherever you go, whether you go to the YMCA or whether you go into a restaurant, people are playing it. It's like I went back in history to when Judge Clarence Thomas was, being presented and the whole Anita Hill thing. And it's all about ideology.
It is.
All about, we've got four liberal justices, four conservative justices, and Kennedy stepped down and is to replace that swing vote, which basically is going to change the court balance for the next 15, probably to 20 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's going to affect abortion rights, religious liberty, and all other things. But again, I go back to what I said yesterday. Our hope as believers is not in whether he gets confirmed or not. And do we want to see a conservative justice on the Supreme Court? I would say yes. Do we know if he's guilty? No. Do we know if she's lying? No. Or do we know if she's telling the truth? No.
We don't. But we do know God is sovereign.
We do. And after they both testify that they both have counter statements with each other, and I'm just going to say this, and then we're going to go. We got a great guest today. We're going to get to him. Is that if it's a he said, she said, with nothing changing, There's still no evidence. And I said yesterday, we pray for her as a victim of something happening to her. And after Washington this morning, I believe something happened to her. I don't know what it was, but something happened. But if it wasn't him and there's an allegation made against him, it's awful. He's a victim as much as she is in that way, that it's ruining his life and reputation. And the whole thing has been weaponized in the political system. And as believers, we have to be very careful not to be pawns in this political war, because Jesus was never about that. He was about us being witnesses. And so That being said, talking about witnesses, I would like to go ahead and introduce our guest today. Brad's wife is here with him in the studio. I don't think she is not on the microphone.
She's already warned me. Do not make me talk. But anyway, I'm going to have to leave at halftime.
Yeah, I saw that.
And then, so I've got.
You've got your
gorgeous wife here.
She's here.
Making sure I'm on time because I'm one of these guys sometimes where she'll text me, where are you? Are you here almost? And I'm like, yeah, I just left a little while ago.
Really?
Not you altogether do that too? Honest.
Well, hey, Jay Warner Wallace is our guest today, and he's a cold case homicide detective. He was out in California doing that, but he now serves as a senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. He's also a professor of apologetics at Biola, and he's a faculty member at Summit Ministries. And here's the thing about Professor Wallace. He was a conscientious and a very vocal atheist until the age of 35, where he took a very serious and expansive look at the evidence for Christian worldview and determined that Christianity was true. And so if you know anybody that struggles with this, any friends, you might want to go ahead and call them, tell them to tune over to 91.7 The Truth here in Jacksonville, 91.9 in St. Augustine, 91.3 in Folkestone, Georgia, or just go to SWATradio.com and click stream live, because we are going to be talking with him and talking about his books. He's got three books out that are great books for dealing with Christian worldview in different settings. And I'm going to let him share about that. But Professor Wallace, welcome to SWAT Radio.
I'm so glad to be here. Are you kidding? It's my pleasure.
Yeah. And do you, I ask this because some people, do you want to, is it Professor Wallace? You want to be called Jim? What do most people talk to you as?
Just call me Jim. There's actually a Jim Wallace from Sojourners in Washington, D.C., and I get mistaken for him on the radio once in a while. So when I first started writing, I used the name Jay Warner Wallace. That was the name I put on my search warrants for years because my grandfather's name was Warner, and that's how I got that name. And as I got to know him growing up, I was like, wow. You know, when you first discover, you know, as a kid that your middle name is Warner, you're like, oh my God, don't have that middle name. I hated it. But
you didn't wear a Little Lord Fauntleroy kind of outfit, did you?
I kind of like it. I mean, seriously, I think it's really cool.
Well, my dad's a James Wallace, but his middle name is David, and I always wanted that middle name. And then I got to know my grandfather, and I was like, wow. So I stopped using my first name, and I started using just the Warner. And people would call me at work, for years as a detective, they would call me Warner.
Well,
because all my reports said J. Warner Wallace. So when I started writing books, I just left that name, but just call me Jim.
Well, you have two endorsements for your book on cold case Christianity. One from Bob Vernon. You and I were talking about Bob earlier. Bob and I are friends, and Bob was the assistant chief of police out in LAPD back under Daryl Gates. And and I want to just read what he says about you, because I think it's helpful for people to understand. This is Bob Vernon was the number two guy out there. And he was also an elder at Grace Church, John MacArthur's pastor up in where Santa Clarita area. Mm-hmm. And Jim Wallace, he said, has a unique way of helping people think logically about God and about spiritual things. He thinks like a cop, being a cold case homicide detective. Now, when I read that, I think of CSI. I think of all these true crime stories of people going years after the fact. And he says the way he puts together the evidence for God in a way everyone can follow. And I've known him, I've worked with him, and I've been with him on the radio, and it's a great ministry. And I'm kind of intrigued a little bit because I was talking to Brad earlier, and about your cold case. Explain to people what a cold case homicide detective does real quick.
Well, okay, so there's only one kind of case. People think, well, and you see this online, if you Google cold case, people don't always know what that even means. But cold cases are of one kind only. Every other crime has a statute of limitations, as you know. So if you do a robbery and a number of years go by, depending on the state jurisdiction, that'll close. It'll close automatically because there's a statute of limitations. But on murder, there is no statute of limitations. It's the 150-state crime that stays open regardless of whether it's solved or not. So if you've got a case of murder, a case that is not solved, This thing will stay open until someone comes along who can solve it. And I've got my cases. I'm in Los Angeles County, so that kind of puts us in the public eye a little bit. And so I've been working these cases that are anywhere from 1979 to like 1990 or so. And these are cases that are unsolved murders, and they're usually unsolved because they were lame to begin with. You know, they didn't have a lot of evidence to begin with, and so these are the kinds that are the most difficult to work. And I think that's why people are fascinated by them. Also, I think that people think about the times in which, you know, can you imagine losing a loved one to a murder and then it going unsolved for a number of years? That's pretty tough. And that is true. We experience all those things for sure. But these are the kinds of cases I work. And because we're here in Los Angeles County, most of my cases have been featured on Dateline because they're close by and they're interested in these kinds of cases. I think I've been on Dateline more than any other detective in the country. And these are just murders, you know, this is unsolved murders. And so that is the perspective that I wasn't raised in the church. You know, I was, you know, raised by my dad's a very committed atheist even now, and he was at the same agency that I'm at. He was there with the same name. I have his name, Jim Wallace. And so he was there from 1961 to 1988. I came on in 88. My son's been there for about 7 years. He has the same name I have. So we have three generations of Jim Wallace who have been working at the same agency. And so we kind of have a collection. We at least are familiar with every murder that's occurred in our city since 1961. And you know, so that's what we kind of have invested our time trying to solve those cases. And that does present you with a set of skills that, believe it or not, is pretty transferable if you're looking at the claims of the New Testament.
Well, I tell people, Jim, that I did not go to seminary. God took me through the FBI to teach me how to investigate. And taking those investigative skills and applying them to the Bible were very valuable for me personally. And with a cold case, isn't it true that most of the evidence comes from witnesses because of the length of time that has elapsed between the actual crime and the evidence that's available? Correct. Is that true?
Well, yeah. So you know, there's only two forms of this. Is what's been helpful, I think, people once they don't know how to build a case, and you learn it sometimes if you've served on a jury, because at some point in that jury process you were selected, you had a voir dire process to interview you, and then at some point we instruct jurors on the rules of evidence, and that might be the first time that people ever give this much thought. But there's only two forms of evidence. There's direct evidence and indirect evidence, and direct evidence is of one kind. It's just eyewitness testimony. Everything else is considered indirect evidence. So if you've got a case that's made on DNA, well, DNA is indirect evidence. Fingerprints are indirect evidence. Material evidences, behaviors, statements he makes, all of that is indirect evidence compared to the one thing that counts as direct evidence, which is eyewitness statements. Now, if you're working a homicide, you're lucky if you have eyewitnesses who saw it occur. But the reason why I don't have any cases like that is because I'm working the ones that didn't get solved. And they didn't get solved for a reason. There was nobody back in the day who could say, I saw it happen. And I'm here to tell you what happened. If that was the case, it would have got solved back in 1979. It didn't get solved back then, so here it makes its way to my desk, and I'm looking at it, and it's lame. I mean, I don't have cases that I made with eyewitness statements. I don't have cases believe me, a lot of cold cases are solved with DNA, no doubt about it. But I don't have cases that are solved with DNA. It's just been my misfortune. I haven't had that kind of luck.
Wow.
So I've got to build these cases a different way, and that was the skill set that I brought in as somebody who was looking at this for the first time. I walked into a church. I was 35 years old. I'd never been in a Protestant, you know, a Reformation or a, you know, kind of evangelical church of any kind for anything other than a wedding or a funeral. My wife and I were together about 18 years, and she had been raised as kind of a cultural Catholic, but she was somebody who attended Mass with her mom growing up, and so she had a sense that there was something out there. Neither one of us were Christians. We were just kind of figuring out, what do we do with our kids? How do we raise our kids? And I think Susie was more inclined to look for some kind of structure that the church might provide, but we didn't know where to go to church. And so I was in this neighborhood about 3 years. I figured we'd just go to the Catholic church down at the corner here. There's a parish right by our house. But we didn't. We had a friend who was attending a big evangelical church, and so I walked in and was kind of – if I'm honest with you, it seemed kind of weird to us, because the only experience that we were familiar with at all was Susie's experience growing up and, you know, kind of attending Catholic churches on, you know, several times a year. So we didn't know what to expect. You know, live worship, and then the pastor was clever. He knew there was a lot of people. There were a lot of people in the room who were unbelievers, and he said a lot of things about Jesus. But the thing that stuck in my mind is that he said that Jesus was the smartest man who had ever lived. And a lot of people have said that over the years, famously. But I had never heard that, and I thought, well. He actually proposed that Jesus was the moral teaching of Jesus from just a couple of sermons, a couple of speeches were the foundation of all Western civilization and our moral thinking. And I thought, here I am enforcing the laws of California, and this guy is saying that Jesus, in essence, is responsible for those in some way, for the kind of foundation for these kinds of moral laws. So I bought a Bible just to see if that was true. And the only way I could approach it was with the skill set that I had. And that was, you know, look at how cold cases work. You have a supplemental report written in 1979 or 1980 or 1985, wherever it is. And more than likely, the witness that you have written about, that first detective wrote about, may not be available to me now because they might be dead. And I've had several cases where the actual detective who wrote the report is no longer available to me either. So now I've got a collection of supplemental reports written by detectives who no longer are available to me, who have interviewed witnesses that are also no longer available to me. Now, how do you begin with that and test those kinds of documents to figure out what really happened? And that's the skill set that most cold case detectives have to develop. And if you think about it, that's exactly what the Gospels are. I've got these written reports. I have no access to the author. I have no access to the eyewitnesses. Say, for example, Luke says he's interviewing eyewitnesses to write the Gospel of Luke. Well, I have no access to Luke's eyewitnesses, and I have no access to Luke. But I do have a skill set that I think we could press in the service that would help us determine if any of that stuff in that Gospel is true.
Well, I love in your book, Cold Case Christianity, you basically, the same thing, and it's not just advice given to jurors in California, it's also given here in Florida, too.
Sure.
When they have to assess a witness, they have to ask, were they really there or were they even there? Have they been honest and accurate, and can they be verified with what they say, and do they have some kind of ulterior motive? And
right.
And that's kind of what you took to it. I guess, and you lay out these principles of resisting presuppositions, which is, you know, and I don't want to get into politics, but when you look at our national right now on the stage of the national stage of anything we're dealing with politically, it's yep. very hard to divorce presuppositions from any kind of investigative thing that is going on right now because of the culture. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, this is why I often say, you know, and you know, we've talked about this a little bit, is that I try my best to be apolitical because I don't think that's where the battle really is. So mm-hmm. So we have these cultural, political concerns and positions that we all hold. And if you think that your friends hold a position they shouldn't hold, in other words, if you think, hey, I want to change their mind on this position X they hold, well, you can either just kind of camp on the position X, or you can figure out, well, what is it that brought you to that conclusion to begin with? And so because I'm a Christian and I believe that these foundational documents are both reliable and should be taken seriously, the Gospels, that's where I camp. I don't go to the X. Instead, I think, what is it that's creating that gets us there? And so I always say I would far rather I focus on two things in my work. I never focus on politics. I'm not interested in those. That's too far downstream for me. What I'm interested in is, do you think that the Bible is true and reliable, and do you take it seriously? Because we're either disagreeing with people who don't believe the Bible is true, and so they're never going to consult the Bible for any information because they don't believe it's true. Okay, so I need to be able to first establish that. Is this true and reliable? Okay, now the next thing is, I may believe it's true and reliable, but I never open it. I never read it. I don't take it seriously. Or I cherry pick out a verse to hold some to support some position I already hold anyway. And so I just don't take it seriously enough to study hermeneutics, or don't take it seriously enough to even open it. That leads to believers to disagree about certain issues. If all of us, though, thought it was reliable, and took it seriously enough to actually read it in context, we're going to end up in almost the exact same position downfield. I don't need to argue about the position, because we're going to end up there pretty darn close anyway if I start with, well, what is your authority, and do you trust it, and do you take it seriously? So I just spend all my time talking about the reliability of Scripture and why we should take it seriously. And I let politics kind of – that's too far downstream for me. And I think – I always say it this way. You know, if you know this – if anyone in your audience has ever worked in patrol – that's what happens for all of us who are detectives. People always say, well, how can I become a homicide detective? Well, you're going to start off with 10 years in patrol probably, because you get hired on as a police officer and you handle all those ridiculous bar fights and domestic violence calls, and you handle all that. Those are all important. And then you eventually might get promoted to detective. So if you're working patrol, you know that if there's like a shots fired officer down or officer needs assistance call, you're going to throw on your lights and siren, and you're going to respond code 3 to that. And as you're responding code 3, you're going to drive by a lot of lesser misdemeanors, a lot of even maybe a felony that's occurring in your presence. But guess what? I'm en route to a shots fired emergency. So guess this is your lucky day. I'm not stopping for that right now. I'm going to go and respond to the shots fired. I think we're in a culture right now that's a shots fired culture. And so I'm not interested in the misdemeanors and felonies that I might drive by. I think what's most important is we have to share that the gospel is the one thing that solves every problem. And if we were all united around the trust that the Scripture was reliable and mm-hmm. took it seriously, that's the shots fired. Everything else we pass by will sort itself out. And I'm okay with disagreeing with – look, you're even going to have – even amongst those people who take the Bible seriously and they read it and they think it's reliable, you're still going to have your share of disagreements. But they're going to be of a lesser kind of texture, a lesser quality than the large presuppositions we all hold right now that divide us as a nation. So I'm not really interested in politics from that perspective. But I do think we could do a lot toward that end if we simply make a case for the Bible.
Jim, it reminds me, Doug, you and I were talking about this, the importance of, you know, whatever it is, if this topic that's going on in Washington's got you hot and bothered, maybe it's important to, this is an opportunity for us to engage with people who may think differently than we do. And as Jim, as you said, really get to the root of how did you come to that conclusion? How did you form those opinions? And, you know, I feel very much the same way. I don't want to argue politics. What I want to find out is, you know, how did you get there? Because we all got where we are because of where we've renewed our mind. Where has our mind been renewed? And if it hadn't been renewed biblically, you can't be surprised that they don't think the way you think.
Well, exactly. And I think the bigger point that for people who are listening who struggle with any issue, whether it's a biblical the biblical veracity of Scripture, I think your point in the book about don't be a know-it-all, resisting presuppositions, as an investigator, it will absolutely get you killed in a courtroom if you presuppose something and go in and you investigate based on that and then come up with your conclusion that you missed something because you already had presupposed. So I love that part of the book. But you also talk about thinking circumstantially. What do you mean by that in your book?
Well, I think that this is, you know, that term. Look, like I said, there's only two forms of evidence. And so if we wanted to make the case for Christianity, and you only have one of two ways to do it. You're going to have to use either direct evidence or indirect evidence. Indirect evidence is also known as circumstantial evidence. And the problem you have with that term is that it's a pejorative for most Americans who don't know really what the distinctions are. They don't know what the differences are. They don't even know what that means, that word. All they know is they've listened to people comment on this who will say things like, oh, all they've got is a circumstantial case. Oh, you can't trust that. It's purely circumstantial. Well, that's about 80% of cases in America are entirely circumstantial. That's 100% of all of my cases. I've never had a direct evidence case. Well, of course not. I mean, I'm working the bad ones. I'm working the ones where if there wasn't a witness, it would have got solved. So I don't have direct cases. I have indirect cases, indirect evidence that I use to make a case. And this is entirely legitimate. As a matter of fact, that's the majority of all cases. And number two, judges in every state instruct juries to treat indirect evidence with the exact same weight in their deliberations, in their consideration, as they treat direct evidence. They are to be given, no one is more valid than the other. So if that's the instruction that is given to jurors, and it is, then we ought to kind of listen to it. And that I think will change the way we look at evidence, because in the end, we're going to have to make an indirect case for the reliability of the scriptures. And so if you automatically assume that indirect evidence is not very good and it really can't be trusted, well, then you're not going to pay attention to anything we have to say, because that's the kind of case we're going to make. But that is, in fact, every case that I make. So I think a lot of this is, and you probably experience this too in working in the FBI, you're going to have cases that it'd be great. I'll be honest with you. When I was working the most difficult of these cases in our agency, I never was interested in direct evidence cases. Those, to me, I hate to say this, but they were too easy. You know, I mean, look, you got a guy who says he saw what happened. Okay, well, can you give it to somebody else then? I want the one that is impossible, because that's the one that's the funnest one to work.
Yeah.
And I happened to work with the district attorney, and we've been friends for 20 years, and we did all of our cases together. We kind of learned how to do this together. I think he was my first homicide trial. He was the prosecutor, and I think it was maybe his second homicide trial. So we kind of learned how to do this together, and he says the same thing. It's like, if he'll look at a case and he'll say, yeah, you know what, that's a good case, let somebody else try it. I'm not interested in that. I want the ones that everyone says there's no way. And that may just be an ego pride thing, but what's helpful about that skill set then is, if that's all you take are the cases that are dang near impossible, well, then you get to something like the Gospels, and you know what? You're equipped. You're ready to go, because that's what the Gospels are. So that was helpful for me when I first started looking at the Gospels.
Wow. That's good. I wish we had about 3 hours with you.
Just going to say, can we get into the O.J. Simpson case? Or?
I know, right? Yeah, so there's so many.
Because I know you speak a lot in Christian circles. Do you get asked that a lot? Do people ask you about that, being from L.A.?
Oh, yeah, constantly. And I've had a case with Robert Shapiro. I had a case that was a 1979 case. That's what I'm always referring to. And that was a case on a lady in our city was killed with a garrote, which is a strangulation device. Pretty rare way to die in America. But it's more popular on TV and movies than it is in real life. But so Robert was the attorney on that. So, you know, I kind of have a sense of how that team works. And they kind of go through the same kinds of steps in every trial they do, you know. So he did the same kinds of motions. He moved it downtown, the same thing he did in OJ, he did with us. But you know, I typically don't comment on other investigations, only because I don't want it to ever seem like one investigator. Hindsight's 20/20, and it's 20/20 for all of us. Even when we do an investigation and we go, wow, I would have done that differently. So I'm always like, I've made a career of not commenting harshly on prior investigations, because that's all I pick up, right? I pick up somebody else's prior investigation that didn't get solved. And so I'm pretty sensitive to the fact that, I mean, I don't want to be that guy who's like, you know, I couldn't solve it, and then we're doing a Dateline, and what happens in my Dateline cases is that, sure enough, the first detective who worked the case, he's also part of that Dateline episode. And what is he stuck saying? He's stuck saying, yeah, I couldn't solve it. Hmm. And then I come in and I solve it. It's pretty uncomfortable, right? I mean, and a lot of the times it's not the detective's fault. It's just that the time does help us to solve certain cases, because people die, and maybe the people that were intimidating to other witnesses are no longer around, or maybe you discover something new that you would never have discovered back in the day. So I think that I try not to, you know, because the temptation is always, well, what do you think he's guilty? Do you think it was a bad investigation? You know, those are the kinds of questions that always come up, and I just try to stay neutral on all that stuff. I hate to say it, but you have to disrespect that. You have to respect the first and best. I remember when I was working homicide, we sat for an afternoon with the lead investigators on the OJ case, just talking about everything that they would have said. I would have done this differently. It would have done that differently. I leave it. You know, it's history. On to the next one.
Yeah, I got that. Well, hey, we're talking to J. Warner Wallace, who is the author of Cold Case Christianity and Forensic Faith. And we're gonna
come back after the break. We're fixing to go to a break, and you're going to be able to stay with us through the break. And I just, again, want to let our listeners know that this book, Cold Case Christianity, is about him taking these homicide detective investigative principles and applying them to the Bible, because he was coming from a, quote, from your own words, an angry atheist background, and then God brought you into his kingdom using these things. So you can go to Amazon.com, get them. Actually, you got a website, coldcasechristianity.com, as well, where they can get these resources as well as other articles and things that you've written as well.
Yeah, so. What is it about you guys out in California? Y'all have great websites, by the way. Hey, Jim, by the way, I noticed Sean McDowell, we were talking about before you got on. Sean was one of our guests a couple months ago. What a neat guy.
No, he is, and we're actually writing a book together. That's our manuscript is due at the end of the year, but we've worked together in so many different settings, and it was Sean who was the first one to suggest I write the Cold Case Christianity. So I only wrote it because Sean said, "Hey, you should write this." he thought he had a connection at a publishing house that could help me get it published, and so if it wasn't for Sean, I wouldn't have written the first book. So
he's got a few connections. Yeah. Hey, Jim, I'm gonna split, so I'm gonna leave the rest of the show to Doug.
All right.
Thanks for being on SWAT Radio.
We'll be right back after the break with Jay Warner Wallace, Cold Case Christianity.
WTRJ, Orange Park, Jacksonville. WAYL, St. Augustine. WATY, Folkston, Georgia. Online at ilovethetruth.com.
Breaking news this hour from townhall.com. I'm John Scott. Forecasters say Tropical Storm Barry could hit Louisiana as a weak hurricane over the weekend. The National Weather Service says New Orleans could get 10 to 15 inches of rain Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. In Jean Lafitte on the southern coast, Mayor Tim Kerner says he has called for the mandatory evacuation of his low-lying bayou town.
What scares me the most about this storm is that the weather's good, the wind's not blowing, and people will sit in Lafitte and think everything's going to be fine, which it may not be. 3 to 5 feet will really hurt us.
Carnival Cruise Line has rerouted a cruise ship headed to New Orleans because of the stormy weather in the Gulf. The House Judiciary Committee has authorized 12 new subpoenas, expanding its ongoing probes to include the administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy.
Among those named in what some are calling a barrage of subpoenas are former Attorney General Jeff Sessions, National Enquirer publisher David Pecker, and former White House Chief of Staff John Kelly. Kelly now serves on the board of Caliburn International. That's a company connected to a privately run detention center for unaccompanied migrant children in Florida.
Capitol Hill correspondent Wally Hines with that report. Also at townhall.com, correspondent Rita Foley reports on what we know about the upcoming immigration raids.
The government will be looking for those who've been ordered out of the country but are still here. These raids are expected in 10 big cities, and although we're hearing they will begin this weekend, we're told it's possible they may start later. Activists are passing out information about hotlines for immigrants and increasing training to make sure they know their rights.
Correspondent Rita Foley. And President Trump expected to announce new executive action during a news conference later this afternoon on the 2020 census and his push to include a citizenship question. On Wall Street, the Dow ahead 169 points. The NASDAQ is down 16. More on these stories at townhall.com.
You're seeing some delays because of an accident in St. Johns County on I-95 northbound beyond State Road 207. Also, there's a broken down vehicle on the East Beltway 295 northbound before Bay Meadows Road, and another disabled vehicle on I-95 northbound just before Lem Turner Road. Mostly cloudy tonight, expect low 74. Friday, partly sunny, high 90.
Good afternoon. You're back with Doug McCary from SWAT Radio with our guest today, Jay Warner Wallace, writer of Cold Case Christianity, God's Crime Scene, and Forensic Faith. And it seems, Jim, that you release a book about every 2 years. So you got one coming out in 19?
Yeah, we do. Sean and I will be releasing a book in 2019, and then we'll see what kind of, you know, at some point you feel like you there's some things you really want to say, and then after you've done that, then it's really about, well, okay, what needs to be said next, not so much what, you know, what have you been waiting your whole life to say? Now it really becomes, well, what needs to be said next? And so we'll see what happens after that. Also, we're kind of wondering if, you know, there's still some investigations I'd like to do in Southern California. So we'll just kind of see where God has, you know, leads us next.
Well, in case you are just tuning in, we're with J. Warner Wallace. He wrote this book called Cold Case Christianity, which is a great book. If you don't even know how to articulate why you believe, the one thing that I really appreciated about just as I was going through your book is you make a statement in your book about why people believe and why they don't. And you say that I knew I could never take a blind leap of faith. For me, the decision to move beyond belief that to belief in needed to be a reasonable decision based on the evidence. And I ask jurors to do this every time I present a case, to assemble the circumstantial evidence and draw the most reasonable inference from what they have examined. That's what I did, as I assembled the cumulative case for the reliability of the Gospels. I would venture to say that if you ask a lot of Christians or people who profess to be Christians today why they believe the Bible, they would just say because it's God's word. I mean, they don't necessarily have an account for how we even got it. And this book, you lay that out, which I think is great, because I don't know that we're called to have this blind faith. When Jesus came on the scene, he healed people. He proved he was Messiah. He referred to the scriptures that said he would come. He gave evidence. And so the disciples, one of the things that you talk about is, as a witness, were they corroborated? Were they accurate? And then I love the chain of custody, because when you deal with evidence, especially in a legal matter, if the evidence has been tampered with, that hurts your case. Well, you talk about this chain of custody for the Gospels, and you actually in your book go down from how John taught Ignatius and Polycarp, who in turn taught Irenaeus, who taught Hippolytus, and then all the way down to Eusebius, and how we kind of got what we have today. And I just want to commend it again. If you're out there, it's a great book for exploring why you believe, even though you may already be a believer. It gives you a good way actually to defend why you believe, doesn't it, Jim?
Well, that's the hope. I mean, a lot of this is, you know, we're trying to take something. Anytime in a jury trial, what you're trying to do is take a complex issue, which could be evidentially complex, and you're trying to simplify it in such a way that, in other words, throw the ball across the center of the plate at 40 miles an hour so that people can swing at it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to take a complex issue, because a lot of this, you know, if I told people we're going to write about church history, well, most people are like, you know what, I'll pass. I'm not really interested in church history. Well, I understand why you might not, on its face, be interested in just the title, but let me show you how this works evidentially to help establish a chain of custody, which is something we do in every criminal trial. And then suddenly people are willing to pay attention, and they're willing, and it's actually presented, I hope, in a way that is memorable so you can rearticulate it to your friends. So when I first started this series, I just knew that my journey was this. I needed to know, could I trust what the New Testament said about Jesus? Because it says that this dude came out of the grave, and I was not inclined to believe anything supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
Long story short, I applied that template that I applied to eyewitness testimony to the Gospels. At the end, I became convinced that it was reporting something true, and that changed everything. But I was hesitant still, because I didn't believe in the supernatural. So I would have said, okay, anything that's in this gospel that does not require a miracle, I might believe that. But don't tell me that the supernatural thing occurred. I don't believe that kind of thing. So I had to examine my presuppositions, my biases against the supernatural. And that's what I talk about in a book called God's Crime Scene. In other words, I had to look at the universe and ask the question, can my naturalistic perspective, in which nothing is available but space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry, can it account for the universe the way it really is? If it can't, if the better explanation is a being that created the universe, well, then I have to at least bend my knee to the possibility of other miracles, because the most powerful miracle would be that an all-powerful being created everything, all space, time, and matter from nothing. And if he has the power to do that, Well, then the walking on water part is nothing, right, compared to that. So mm-hmm. I had to at least abandon my bias against the supernatural if the best explanation for the evidence in the universe is a divine being. And that's what I talk about in God's Crime Scene. So this really just traces my own investigation, right? Start off with the New Testament, get stuck on the presupposition of naturalism, move past it by doing the work I did in God's Crime Scene. And then what forensic faith basically is simply this. You just said it. The problem you have is that if you were to tell somebody at church that you are making the case for Christianity, they're going, why are you doing that? I mean, I already believe it. I don't need to hear that. But why would you even waste your time doing that? In other words, there is this sense the church has that they don't need any reasoning to support their faith. But they wouldn't. Why would you call it faith if you're using evidence? Isn't faith just the thing you trust because of the claim made in Scripture? And you don't need any evidence to support that. That was never the approach that Jesus took, ever. He always said, hey, if you don't believe what I'm saying, believe the evidence of these miracles or believe the testimony of John the Baptist. He would constantly point to either direct or indirect evidence to make his case. Even when John the Baptist was having doubts and he's in custody and he sends his disciples to Jesus, what does Jesus do with those disciples? He doesn't scold him for not having enough faith. He instead does three miracles in front of John's disciples and says, go back and tell John what you just saw. What is he doing? Indirect evidence to support his claim. And this is what he does throughout Scripture. And I realized at some point that before I could make a case for Christianity to the church with a big C, I had to make the case for why we should be making a case. And that's what forensic faith does. It tries to find a biblical definition of the word faith, which most people don't embrace. They have their own definition of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And then talk about, you know, what are the tools that we use as first responders? We use certain tools. We have a certain process that I think will help the church in terms of how you prepare, how you train, how you investigate claims, and finally, how you communicate these claims to others. So the third book in this trilogy is really about communicating the truth to others. It's more of an evangelism kind of book, and that's what forensic faith is all about.
Well, I want to go back to God's Crime Scene for a minute, because in that book, you basically take the approach of, like, when you find any victim, you talk about where you have to basically determine the cause of death. If somebody's dead, you got to determine whether it was an accident, a natural cause, a suicide, or somebody else on the scene, an intruder, or somebody who, you know, a perpetrator who came in into that person's life that took their life. Well, in the same way, you kind of take that approach to the universe, right? In that the essence of that book, what you're doing is you say you're going to assess what is a reasonable standard of proof as you're looking at the universe. Isn't it about creation? Isn't that the essence of that, what you're trying to do with God? Or am I missing something there?
No, absolutely. So what I'm trying to do is to find a way to communicate this in a way that is memorable for people. What are the basic principles being used here? So, for example, I always talk about it this way. Not every death scene is a crime scene, because there's four ways to die. Only one of those four ways is criminal. You could die accidentally, naturally, or suicide, and we're not going to investigate it as a homicide. That's the fourth option.
Yeah.
But we're not going to investigate it that way, because it's not a homicide. It's either a suicide, natural, or an accidental. Well, how do you tell the difference? And I always say it's pretty simple. You simply ask this question when you get in the room with the dead guy. You say, okay, can I explain everything in the room by staying in the room? If I can explain everything in the room by staying in the room, there's a good chance it's not a murder. So if I see there's a pistol laying in the room, but it's his pistol, and there's only one shot been fired, and there's a suicide note laying next to the body, and it's his handwriting on his paper I find elsewhere in the room. The room is locked from the inside. There's no evidence anywhere in the room that anyone outside has been inside the room other than the victim. Well, this is probably going to be a suicide or an accidental.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if on the other hand, that's not his pistol, he's been shot four times in the back, there's bloody footprints leading out of the room. Now, this is very different. Now I can't explain the stuff that's in the room by staying in the room. I got a cause I'm looking for, which clearly is outside the room. That would account for the gun and the bloody footprints and everything else. So now I have to shift toward homicide, because the best explanation for the stuff in the room is a cause outside the room. Now, if you took that same approach and applied it to the universe, you'd have to say, okay, I meant this natural. The room is the natural universe, all space, time, matter, governed by physics and chemistry. Can I explain everything that's in that room by staying in the room? Or is there a better explanation outside of naturalism, outside of space-time, matter, physics, and chemistry? And if that's the case, again, what we're doing here is really kind of an intruder investigation. Do we have good evidence that there's an intruder? If we do, we have to move toward that. And I think that the best explanation for the beginning of the universe, the fine-tuning of the universe, the appearance of life in the universe, the appearance of design in biology, the existence of minds and free agency, and the existence of moral truths, and even the standard of righteousness by which we would cause and call anything evil, those things, I think, are best explained by a cause outside the room, and that's what that book does. I look at every explanation that's offered by atheists or by naturalists to explain those eight things by staying inside the room. None of those work, by the way. And then I offer the explanation, which is pretty obvious, that it's outside the room. It's a personal being that is the standard of righteousness that I think is the best explanation for the stuff in the room. And so that's what that book tries to do. And that's what I had to do in order to leave my presupposition that, nope, I can explain this with physics. And once I got to the point where I realized I can't explain any of those things with physics,
yeah,
then I was able to let down my guard.
Well, I love what you say, because people listening to this, by the way, you know, when I hear you talk about a murder suspect or something like that, it doesn't make me very queasy because I'm used to doing investigations.
That's right.
But some of our listeners may not be used to that. But, you know, I'll tell you, you know, my kids sometimes watch some of these CSIs, and they're pretty graphic. What they're showing today, that's real life. You know, that's
well,
stuff
how about
that
Criminal Minds? I mean, some of these, I didn't realize how bad Criminal Minds was until I finally sat down and caught an episode, and I thought, well, you know, that's they've kind of pushed the genre about as far as you can push this, right? So
yeah, it's pretty bad. You make a comment in your book that I love. It's, you say, one way to overcome our discomfort with the idea of a divine intruder, which is the way you refer to God in this, is to think that the nature of our home and the identity of the intruder. I bet you never think of yourself as an intruder when you come home after a day at work or an afternoon of running errands. At your house, you are the inhabitant. You're not the intruder. You can't be an intruder in your own home. The divine intruder we've described as a source for all the cosmological, biological, mental, and moral evidence in the universe is the creator of our home. It's his house. He's still the primary owner and inhabitant. In our limited, self-focused view of reality, we've imagined this to be our universe, when in fact it's his. We are his guests. We are the one living in the universe God created. Resisting the existence of our creator and landlord and viewing him as the intruder in our lives. I love that line. That's just a great perspective, because I do think we lose sight of that in there. And I don't know how much you explore that more in that understanding the nature of the divine intruder, but I think that you really do a good job. And so if you're listening, that's called God's Crime Scene, A Cold Case Directive Examines the Evidence for a Divinely Created Universe. And by the way, you have a children's book that one of my guys in my Bible study told me about. It's called God's Crime Scene for Kids, for kids 8 to 12. Parents, if you got kids in the 8 to 12 range, he actually takes you, I think it's almost like a story, right? Don't you take them through like somebody actually finding something, and then you're looking at it through the eyes of a detective as they kind of go through that? Can you talk about the kids' book for a second?
Sure. What we did, all the adult books have a kids' version, and we created a Casemakers Academy for kids 8 to 12. And you just go type on casemakersacademy.com, and you'll see that all three books are supported by videos for each chapter, printout sheets for each chapter, activity sheets, fill-in sheets, parent guides for each chapter. And in the end, your cadets who take the course can earn a certificate. And so I see, you know, we've even got an honor cadet wall where you can see all the other kids who have read the three books and have now earned a certificate. We put them on the honor cadet wall. And so the idea here is that we've got three books that are not just going to tell you what the evidence is. There are three mysteries involving, you know, a skateboard, and one's got a shoebox, and one's involving a little corgi puppy. And the idea here is that you have this mystery presented to you, and you have to learn how to think like a detective. The characters in the book are just cadets at an explorer academy learning from a master detective. They're trying to solve the mystery of the skateboard, or the mystery of the puppy, But along the way, they're learning a skill set that he cleverly turns, I hope, and turns it toward the case for God or the case for Christianity. So what you're hopefully we're doing here is teaching kids how to make a case, how to investigate a case, and then applying that to the Christian worldview. And so those are books have been lots of fun to you know, I was an illustrator before I was a detective, and so I came out of UCLA as an architect finally, and then I became a police officer because my dad was a cop, and those kind of things draw you back. But so I get to illustrate my own books, and so we tried to make sure that those kids' books are really robustly illustrated. We made sure that every page has got a graphic element, and there's all kinds of interactive activity available at the Casemakers Academy. And I'll tell you, we wrote those for 8 to 12 for a reason, because we felt like we know that it used to be that 85% of Christians became Christians by the age of 18. Only 15% of Christians became Christians after 18. Well, that has now dropped to 13.
Wow.
And it's going to continue to drop because young people have access to skepticism in a way they didn't previously have access to it. They have access by way of the internet. And so it might be that, you know, back in my day, the first time you would encounter skepticism would be while you're in college. You're 19 years old now. But now, the first time you're going to engage skepticism is going to be when you're still, you know, you're still in elementary school. That's the sad thing about it. People sometimes think, well, yeah, you know, we got to train up our kids better because if we send them to college, then there's a good chance they're going to walk away from their faith. Hey, trust me, it's not happening in college. It's happening while they're still with you. They just haven't told you. Now, when they get to college, they will walk away robustly and they'll voice it. But that happened years prior. And when we do, and I've been collecting these data for since 1999. When young people say, "When did you leave?" they'll typically say it's between the ages. And we have three studies now that tell us this. Between the ages of 10 and 17 are when most kids say, "Nope, this isn't true." So we got to do a better job of, number one, redefining and back to the proper definition of what faith is to begin with, and then, two, do what the disciples always did. You know, when the disciples went through the first century and proclaimed them at the gospel, they didn't, you know, there's lots of good ways to do this, but they didn't start off by, you know, have you ever lied? Oh, you're a liar. Have you ever stolen? Well, you're a thief. No, they basically said, hey, the Old Testament predicted A, B, and C, and we saw it happen with our own eyes. In other words, they demonstrated as eyewitnesses, they testified to the resurrection. And that's where I think we have to be able to testify what is the evidence for the resurrection, and most of us are not prepared to do that. We are prepared to give our personal testimony, but that's different. I mean, I'll tell you, I'm not interested in my personal testimony, and I'm glad you didn't even ask for it because I don't think it matters. It doesn't matter how I became a Christian. What matters is Christianity true? Because everyone, all Mormons have a testimony. All Buddhists have a testimony. All Muslims have a testimony. It doesn't make those systems true. And so I'm not really interested in anyone's testimony. I'm only interested in the testimony of the apostles because they're the ones who saw Jesus and didn't know if it was true or not. And so that's really where I camp on most of this work, the work in our ministry, is to help people see that this is evidentially true. Whether you like it or not, or whether you've had an experience that's remarkable or not, it doesn't really matter. It's you're stuck with it either way.
Well, I one of the things terms you use is a casemaker, and you talk about two decision Christian: first, to believe what the gospel writers are telling us, and then a second, to become a Christian casemaker. And basically, what you're asking people to do is to get in the game, to be able to wherever you are, whether you're at work or whether you're in your neighborhood. But to devote yourself to the truth and be able to give a defense. And I think it's really important for us to do that with our children. That's why I like the idea. You're the first person I know. Well, not the first person. I mean, I know there's other children books of adult books, but you've seemed to incorporate that into your plan that, you know, if you release an adult book, there's automatically going to be a children's book to kind of make sure that the 8 to 12 year olds get this as well. And and I think that's discipleship for us as parents, to be taking our kids through this. So it is a great thing. It's called Cold Case Christianity for Kids, God's Crime Scene for Kids, and I guess now forensic faith for kids as well, right?
That's right. It's all available now. And you're right about this. I mean, sometimes it's done automatically by the publisher. They'll just kind of, you know, knock it out for you and they'll make it available. But we wanted to take great care in building these as special, as separate books. So that's why we've produced a book a year. And I will tell you, we put more time and effort into those kids' versions than we did in the adult versions because it takes so long to illustrate them and create all the activities that are available on Casemakers Academy. We had to create all that stuff. So those kids' books have been really a labor of love, but they, for the most part, have been, you know, an effort for us to try to do something that we think is missing. And we do think that is missing right now in the church.
Well, I agree. And I just also wanted to let our listeners know that when you go coldcasechristianity.com is the primary site, but he also gave us another site for the kids. It's Casemakers Academy, and that's CaseMakersAcademy.com. Where they go, they can get the books there as well. There's also, you said there's videos there. So parents, that is a great resource for you. And also coldcasechristianity.com is that's your primary website. That, yes. They can also get your podcast through that website as well, right?
Absolutely. And you know, that's where we link to everything. So all the stuff that we do is we're linked to all the Kids Academy are linked there. We try to produce content 5 days a week for readers so that they can, you know, have resources every day to help become a better casemaker themselves. That's really the goal, is to what can we do? You know, you sell books, I get that. Those are the best place, the deep dive on all the issues. But we wanted to provide free resources as deeply as we can, and that's what we're trying to do with the website.
Okay. Well, we've talked about Cold Case Christianity, and we've talked about God's crime scene. I want to talk a little bit about forensic faith. As we you know, As an apologetics guy, you know, you're basically saying in this book, you're wanting people to be proactive in their defense of the gospel, correct? Isn't that really what you're trying to get across in forensic?
Yeah, I think what happened for us is we are traveling around the country presenting the case for Christianity, the case for God's existence. We discovered that a lot of people were resistant to hearing the case. They almost thought it was like unbiblical to make this kind, to assume that humans have the capacity to understand the evidence, that it's not all just purely the sovereignty of God that brings people to faith. That was a claim we heard over and over again, and we saw that, you know, most of the time it'd be like an elder or a deacon of a church who would finally convince the pastor to let somebody talk about Christian apologetics, because the pastor was like, this is not important. So we really knew that we had to make a case for making the case before anyone was going to be interested in defending the case. And if all this did, and I always tell people, if you want to bring apologetics into your local church, tap into the mothers of junior hires, because those are the ones who already are seeing something that's disturbing. They're already seeing that it's a little harder to get their kids interested, especially probably their boys, interested in these claims. They'll go to church with us, and they'll continue to do all that to be good and obedient. But moms are pretty sensitive to this. If you're interested in Christianity and you take it seriously, you might start to notice that your kids are less interested. Mm-hmm. And when that there are other things competing for their attention. And that's when you realize, man, we've got to figure out how do we ignite a passion in our kids, especially in a culture where kids are more inclined to believe that, hey, whatever's working for you is great, doesn't work for me, your truth is your truth, my truth is my truth, nothing's really all that important. We have to be able to figure out a way to help them see the difference between subjective claims and objective claims. We do this in front of every jury. Can you imagine if we picked jurors who really thought, well, you know, it's no way to distinguish between two sides in a case. You know, the victim's going to say this, or the victim's family's going to say this, the suspect and his family's going to say that, and, you know, they're both equally, really? Well, most of the time, that's where the rubber meets the road. It's in jury trials where someone's going to be tasked with rendering a verdict.
Yeah.
So I always say that with young people, we have to provide two whys for every what. You might tell your kids what you believe as a Christian, but they want to know, number one, well, okay, but why? Why do you believe that? Why is that true? Do you have any evidence for that? Mm-hmm. The second why is, why does that matter to me? Mm-hmm. Okay, you can tell me what you think is true about God and the triune nature of God or the deity of Christ. Okay, number one, do you have any evidence to support that? That's the first why. Why do you think it's true? Number two, even if it was true, why should I care? That's the second why. And so we have to move people toward those two whys. If we don't, we're going to end up with kids who are not, well, you know, everyone's making a claim. Why should I consider this claim any more viable than any other claim? Especially when there's better video for all the other claims. There's more entertaining media for all the other claims. And I'm saturated online. Type in Christianity on a Google search and see what you get. You're only, probably about a third will actually be Christian websites. Most will be non-Christian websites saying something about Christianity. So I think we need to do a better job of taking charge of this. But it starts with you recognizing, number one, that the most popular answers the church usually gives, I was raised in the church, that's why I'm a Christian, or I had an experience and that's why I'm a Christian, are lame answers. If those are your answers, really? Those are the same two answers for why Mormons are Mormons, and the same two answers for why Muslims are Muslims. And you don't believe those systems are true.
Yeah.
So you're telling me that you think that your experience and you being raised in your church makes it true?
Yeah.
No. This is everyone's response. So so the question is how do I demonstrate that it's true in a way that young people will go, yeah, that's important. Look, in the end, if this is just a matter of opinion like your favorite cookie, then why should I care to share it with anybody?
Yeah.
But if this is the cure for what's killing us, I might want to share that. So the question is, do our kids see Christianity more like a cookie or a cure?
Yeah.
And we have to be able to help them see that it's more like a cure.
Yeah. Wow. Hey, I want you back. I want to talk more because this has been great, and our time is out. We literally got about 30 seconds. I want to real quick, coldcasechristianity.com, casemakersacademy.com. You can get the books on the website. J. Warner Wallace, thank you so much. God bless you, and have a great weekend, okay?
Thanks, brother, for having me. I appreciate you.
Okay, take care.